Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
And good evening. This is KBOO Portland. The time is just squeaking right before 6 o'clock, and so coming up next is Bread and Roses Feminist News and Public Affairs right here on KBOO Community Radio. And that's coming up right after these messages.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Triangle Productions run of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche, starting November 28th and ending on December 20th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. This is a comedic look at the window of 1956's Susan B. Anthony Society for the Sisters of Gertrude Stein, as they sit in their renovated community center, sharing secrets as the threat of atomic apocalypse nibbles at their heels. Again, that's the Triangle Productions performance of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
On Monday, December 22nd, at 6:30 p.m., Prison Pipeline will be airing a holiday special to bring to light the fact that so many people are incarcerated or have friends or family members that are incarcerated during the holidays. We will be reading your short messages to your friends and loved ones on air. So whether you are behind bars and reaching out or are out and reaching in, we welcome you to mail or email us your holiday messages. Our email address is kboppc@gmail.com, and our address is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Address your messages to Prison Pipeline Collective. Then tune in on December 22nd at 6:30 p.m. to hear your messages read on air.
Bread and Roses. Bread and Roses is a collective of women-identified radio activists bringing you feminist news and public affairs programming every Friday at 6 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 FM. Women have had this forum on KBOO since 1978. That is 36 years, folks. We always welcome new collective members, so if you would like to host, produce, or engineer with us, you can contact KBOO's volunteer manager. Her name is Ani Haynes. Her email is volunteer@kboo.org. Of course, you can find us on the web, kboo.fm/breadandroses. There you can listen to past shows, share comments, or show ideas. And of course, we are on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Roses. I'm your host this evening, Delphine Crescenzo, and our engineer is Brooke. Tonight on Bread and Roses, we discuss the new Portland Pioneers of Color walking tour. This tour of downtown Portland highlights the stories of the city's early African-American citizens, persons freed from the institution of slavery, who came to Portland in search for freedom, independence, community, and economic opportunity. Every Saturdays, rain or shine, Stephen Hanks walks you around downtown while sharing the most fascinating details about the lives of some of the first Black people to live in Portland. Stephen Hanks is joining us this evening on the phone. He's a local genealogist from Portland and a specialist in African-American genealogy. In 2006, he was a contributor to the PBS special African-American Lives, Oprah's Roots, hosted by Dr. Henry Louis Gates, which traced the ancestry of Oprah Winfrey. Stephen's new book, A Key Tree, A Descendant's Quest, quest for his ancestors on the Esk Ridge plantations was released last year. The book tells the story of Stephen's 10-year project to trace his father's family and how he discovered one of his African ancestors. Stephen designed the Portland Pioneers of Color walking tour and researched all of the information he shares on the tour, which he gives every Saturdays and selected days. The tour lasts an hour and a half and meets on the east side of Southwest First and Ankeny, right next to the Portland Saturday Market. You can find out more information on Facebook about dates and time for the tour. Look for Portland Pioneers of Color Walking Tour. And there's a tour tomorrow, Saturday, starts at 1:30 p.m. And I'd love to encourage you all, listeners, to take the tour. And here is why I'd like to encourage you to do that. In recent weeks, we all know the non-indictment of police officers for the assassinations of both Michael Brown and Eric Garner has made many of us wonder what we can do to change things. And here's my suggestions, folks. We can learn about history. We can learn about the experiences, the lives, the leadership initiatives of those who were here before us. And believe me, I know this is a cliche, but I'm not inviting you to open a history book. I'm inviting you to seek out the stories that don't make it into the history books and questions why they do not. Stephen Hanks, our guest this evening, has done just that. He spent years collecting the clues and bringing back to life the stories of Portland's pioneers of colors into this walking tour. This is a true gift for the community. Stephen, thank you so much for your hard work and dedication, and welcome to Bread and Roses.
Well, thank you very much, Delphine. Appreciate to be a guest on your show tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much. And thank you for taking the time to sit with us this evening and talk a little bit about the tour and also about your passion. I'd love if you could start there. Tell us about your true passion for history, genealogy, and also for storytelling. Talk about how you became so involved in investigating the past of your family and the past of Portland, which is your hometown.
Oh, certainly, Delphine. Actually, it started in 1989. I didn't know anything about my father's side of the family, and just one day, out of the blue, my dad and I were watching the baseball game one summer, and he had a letter that came in the mail from his aunt from Kansas, and I opened it up, and it was an obituary. One of his cousins had passed away. He was the first African-American mayor of Manhattan, Kansas. And, of course, that's the hometown of Kansas State University. So from there, I just got really involved in trying to learn more about my father's side of the family, who I never knew anything about. And my father is still alive today, Zane Hanks. I love him to death. Bless him. And he might be listening tonight. And so this tour is kind of in dedication to him and to my mother, who I just lost in April of this year. But she lived a good full life, 89. She would have been turning 90 in 2 weeks, and she loved history also, and I think I got a lot of that from her. So that's kind of how my passion for history and genealogy got started, and I started writing and documenting, started going across the country to different courthouses. I went to interview relatives and so forth, went to Kansas, Mississippi, Tennessee, Virginia, or else, who knows.
You also traveled to Africa, I believe you said,
Côte d'Ivoire. Eventually, I started in 1989, and by 1999, 10 years later, I was on a plane flying to Ivory Coast to document this African tribe that I was able to figure out my African ancestor had come from this tribe based on the research of the name and the linguistics of the name and so forth. This African ancestor, I found him on a Virginia plantation in the year 1736. He was listed in a state inventory in a court record. And I had no idea that I would even find this when I started that project, back back then, but it was a joy to find that. So that's how my passion got started.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so then you took that passion to actually investigate the history of Portland. Let's start delving a little bit on some of the stories of the pioneers of color that you introduce on your tour of downtown. Maybe you can lay out for us the city in the 1800s and the presence of African Americans in the Portland area.
Oh, certainly. Yes, well, as we know, Oregon became a state in 1859. And at that time, believe it or not, there were only 16 African Americans living in Portland in that year, according to the 1860 federal census. Only 16. But by 1870, it had grown to 146. Mm. And the word got out that Oregon was a free state. And so many African American African American pioneers, many of them had come to California because of the gold rush, mm-hmm. and when that started to die down, they were looking for other opportunities for economic empowerment, and of course Washington State was one place, but then they heard about Oregon, so many of them came here, and they came to Portland to try it out. And of course when Portland, back in the 1850s, 1860s, there was only one main street, and that was Natal Parkway, which is downtown, which mm-hmm. back then was called Front Avenue. Many of us who lived here long enough remember that it was used to be called Front Avenue. And Front Avenue was just full of business back then. You had European merchants. You had, of course, this new pioneers of African color coming in, trying to establish their economic spot. Mm-hmm. In society, you had Chinese that were coming in, and also the Native Americans. So you had all this melting pot there right on Front Avenue. And, of course, if you go down to Front Avenue today, you go down to Saturday Market, you notice that most of the businesses are on the west side of the street. There's no mm-hmm. businesses on the east side where the river is and where the Atomical Waterfront Park is. But back in 1860s, 1870s, business was on both sides of the street. And it was just all kind of occupations, and ships would come in as well. There were no bridges at the time. First bridge was the Morrison Bridge. That didn't come in until 1887, 1889. So mm-hmm. getting over the Willamette River, you'd have to take, either steamship or boat. So it was mostly just horses, horse and buggy. And then, of course, that turned into the railroads came in later in the 1890s, of course. But it was just a place that was just full of opportunity, and many African Americans came out to Portland to see what it was all about.
Mm-hmm. And so what are some of the jobs and occupations that these pioneers of colors had?
Oh, there was a lot of occupations that they were able to, some were able to create their own little niche, and then others just the traditional occupations such as cooks, waiters. There were shipmakers. There were shoemakers, ship workers. There were cooks, obviously. There was even restaurant owners. There were saloon owners, barbers, barbershops. There were hairdressers. And then, of course, there were the shoeshine people who did shoeshine. They made a living doing that. There were butchers, just all kind of different construction workers, which they had various type of terms that they would use. And it was a lot of work going on there, mm-hmm. and not everyone was able to make it. There was a lot of financial losses for a lot of them, but many of them, boarding houses was another one, and so everyone was trying to do what they could to survive.
Mm-hmm. And so very early, I took the tour, which is wonderful. And very early in the tour, that was one of the questions that I had was around the exclusion laws. I was wondering if you can talk a little bit, as we talk about the presence of African Americans here, I know maybe lots of people might be aware that there were exclusion laws that prohibited African Americans to be in Portland and in the state. So can you talk a little bit about what they are? And this one time where it was tested in Portland in 1851, a story that you tell on the tour as well.
Yes, yes. There were three exclusion laws in Oregon's history, and two of them were before Oregon became a state. But I'll talk about the last two. There was one that was the 1849 exclusion law, And if I could just quote from my book,
there's
a chapter in my book that talks a little bit about the exclusion law, and it mentions here, I'll just quote the law. It says that any free Negro or mulatto shall have come to Oregon, he or she, if of the age of 18 or up or upward, shall remove and leave the country within 2 years for males and 3 years for females. If any such free Negro or mulatto shall fail to quit the country, they may be arrested, and if guilty upon trial, shall receive upon his or her bare back not less than 20 nor more than 39 stripes. And of course, it didn't really get tested, but the citizens of Oregon felt that was a little bit too harsh to get the 39 lashes on your bare back. So they kind of reduced that to hard labor. But that was the 1849 exclusion law. The next law that came was the 1857 exclusion law. That one was written right into the Oregon Constitution, and it came in about the time when the Oregon Territory was legislating for becoming a state to join the Union. So it was written right into the Constitution, and according to that exclusion law, if I could read the wording of that, no free Negro or mulatto not residing in this state at the time of the adoption of this Constitution shall come, reside, or be within this state, or hold any real estate, or make any contracts, or maintain any suit therein. Mm-hmm. And the legislative assembly shall provide by penal laws for the removal of all such Negroes and mulattoes, and for their effectual exclusion from the state. Fortunately, that exclusion law finally got repealed after many, many efforts, many, many decades. It finally got repealed in 1926, but it took a long time. And we'll talk about that on the tour also. Some of the people who were involved in helping to get that law repealed, there was several key African-American pioneers that came here. But the 1849 exclusion law was tested, as you mentioned, in 1851. There was a African-American couple by the name of Abner and Linda Hunt who came to Portland in 1851. They came here from New York. Abner Hunt was a very successful clothing businessman. He had some clothing stores in Detroit, Michigan, and in New York. He heard about the gold mine, gold rush, and so he came out to California. Eventually, they came out to Portland. And Abner's brother, Obie Francis, came out with him. Well, Abner's brother got arrested one day, and he was put on trial, convicted, and was sentenced to leave the country. They gave him 6 months to leave, which was very generous because normally it was, say, 30 days. But they appealed it, and it was struck down by the Oregon Legislature Supreme Court. So the only thing that Abner and his wife could think about doing at this point, and now time was running out, and now he only had 4 months left before his brother was going to be deported. Abner and his wife went around the city of Portland with a petition asking for the Portland citizens to sign this petition allowing his brother to stay. They were able to get over 200 signatures. One of the signatures was even the editor of the Oregonian newspaper, Thomas Dreyer. And they submitted that to the legislative body. They reviewed it, and they were able to grant an exemption in this case, and they allowed Abner's brother, OB, to stay. And that was the only time that it was ever tested in Portland. And fortunately, it was a good ending to that, that they granted an exemption, which normally they would not have done. So there was another time where it was tested also in Salem. There was an African-American pioneer by the name of Jacob Vanderpool. He was a businessman, and he also was arrested and convicted under this exclusion law of 1849, and he was deported. So that was the only time in the state of history of our state where the law did eventually deport a human being because of his race out of the country. It didn't happen in Portland, but it came very close.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other little details that we'll talk about on the tour as well of how that all came about and
mm-hmm.
and how that ended up.
Yes. And folks, Stephen really has all of this memorized. He is a wonderful storyteller.
I'm trying to remember. I'm drinking my coffee to keep myself going. I'm loving it, though. I love history. Love to talk about it.
Yes, and we're so thankful that you're here talking with us. We're going to take a short musical break, and then when we come back, we're going to talk more about some of the great businesses and then other awesome leadership initiatives that happen in the city with trying to integrate schools and other things like that. So stay tuned. This is Bread and Roses. We are talking with Stephen Hanks, who is local genealogist and historian, and he is telling us about a tour that he put together, Portland's Pioneer of Color Walking Tour. I'd like to encourage you to take the tour and also go to their Facebook page to find out more about it. We're going to go to Head to the Sky. This is Earth, Wind, and Fire. We'll be right back. Listening to Bread and Roses. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm joined on the phone this evening by Stephen Hanks. And Stephen has put together Portland's Pioneers of Color Walking Tour of downtown Portland, highlights the stories of the city's early African-American citizens. And Stephen, can you actually start talking about the saloons? Like, there were many, many saloons on the tour, many times when we stopped and talked about those saloons, and some of them were actually owned by African Americans during the 1800s. Can you talk about that?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there were a lot of saloons in downtown Portland. And, of course, you know, people love to get out, have a good time, and it wasn't any different back then either, 1860s, 1870s. You had saloons all on Front Avenue, Morrison Street, Alder. We'll look It's on the tour. We go to the actual locations of where some of these were at, and there was one saloon over in northwest side of town, northwest Portland downtown, called the Arcadia Saloon. It was started in 1899 by two business people, Burr Williams and a female entrepreneur called Mrs. St. Clair, who came out here from Kentucky. And her and Burr Williams decided to go into business together, and they opened up this saloon in 1899, and it lasted for a few years. And then there was also another saloon that was right next door called the Julia Sevier Saloon,
mm-hmm.
and it came up right close to, right at the turn of the century, about 1899-1900. And Julia Sevier, he came out here from Nebraska, him and his wife, Faye. and they had a saloon over there in Northwest Portland. Of course, saloon, the word saloon to us today, we think about a place where there's drinking and partying and card dealing, gambling, and of course, certainly was a lot of that then mm-hmm. as well. But the word saloon back in the 1870s, 1860s, it also referred to a salon. Mm. Oftentimes they would use the word saloon, but it was a salon where people could come in and get their hair cut, men, women, children get their hair, their beards trimmed. They could even come in and do bathing. They would have bathing rooms. And there was two African-American businessmen, pioneers, that came to Portland. They opened up what was called the Humboldt Saloon mm. in 1872, George Riley and James Givens. And they were both born in Massachusetts during the 1830s, came out here to Portland early 1870s, and they opened up the saloon right on Front Avenue. And it was, in fact, it was a bathing, hair cutting, mm-hmm. hairstyles. They had advertisements that they even put in the Oregonian newspaper, even inviting the public to come. And so that was very interesting that their clientele were people of all colors. And, you know, they came in and, you know, cut your hair or trim your beard, or, you know, the women would come in and get their hair fashioned. They bring their children in. And they would also have the bathing, kind of like a sauna room today and a salon. Mm. So, interesting. And there was another saloon also that we talk about on the tour. It was called the Cornucopia Saloon, 1869. And it was owned by an African-American pioneer named Alfred Carr, who came out to Portland. He was here at least by 1863, 64, somewhere in there. And we talk a lot about him. We have some good stories to tell about some of the things that went down in his saloon. But he was a business owner, and he had that saloon for at least for a good 10 years there. And we will go to the actual location where that was at. So we're trying to document some more saloons. There's one that I'm still trying to find out about. I don't know who the owner is, but the name of the saloon was called the Ivy Green Saloon. And if anybody out there knows anything about that, please let me know, because I am trying to document it, and so far I haven't found out. But we're going to keep looking for more stories to add to the tour, and yeah, definitely.
So could people maybe send you a message on Facebook, Pioneers of Color Walking Tour Facebook page?
They could do Facebook, and they also can send it to my email us on Portland Pioneers of Color Tours at yahoo.com.
Great.
And our website or our email is on our Facebook page too. So please send us any clues or any stories that you hear about. We'd love to research them and put them on the tour.
Absolutely. This is what the show is about. It's about, let's seek out those stories. Let's find out what's happening. What was happening then? I would like for you to talk a little bit about, you tell us the story of two very influential women pioneer, black women pioneers that you introduced to us on the tour. Can you talk about them? Mary Carr is one, and then there's Cecilia Blackwell.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely. Yes, Mary Carr and Cecilia Blackwell, two very wonderful stories that brought a lot of joy to me in researching them. Mm. And Mary Carr, she, according to the federal census record, she says Indiana. So I'm thinking she might have been born in Indiana, but says that she grew up in Pennsylvania. Well, she was here in Portland by 1858. Delphine, 1858. She was here. Amazing. I don't know anything about who she came out here with, other than her husband. But she was here by 1858, and she opened up a boarding house. She was able to read and write as well. She was born in 1830, but she was somehow able to read and write. And we will see the actual location of where her boarding house used to be in downtown. And she ran that from like 1864 until about 1872 in this one location. And she would, her name was in the Portland Directory those years. And she ran a very tight ship from what the Oregonian said about her. We have a picture of her, not a picture, but I wish we'd have a picture of her. unfortunately, we don't have a photograph of her, but we do have some photographs of some of the pioneers on the tour. We'll show you the photographs and also some photocopies of some of the obituaries and news articles of interest. Mm-hmm. We did find her obituary, and very interesting. But it says that she ran a tight ship in that boarding house. She didn't take any mess from anybody, and her boarding house was open to anybody, you know, black, mm-hmm. white, whoever. Mm-hmm. If you needed a place to stay and you had the money to pay it, come on in, you mm-hmm. know. Money is money. So she was very inspirational to learn about,
Something that I just wanted to specify about. You know, you talked about the saloons and the salons earlier. These businesses were also catering to anybody. It was,
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then, of course, Cecilia Blackwell, very, very interesting. And I still would like to research more and see if I could find more about her. But Cecilia Blackwell was a very interesting person. On the federal census records, she's listed under three different names, and that's why it was kind of hard to try to piece her story together, but mm-hmm. I was able to get a pretty good profile so far, but I'd like to grow more on it. But she was born in 1848 in Virginia, and she came to Portland, we think, at least by 1870, maybe sooner, but she was 22 years old when she came to Portland. We don't know anything about her parents, if she came with her family or siblings. Any relatives, we don't know. But in 1870, she was working as a domestic in the home of a furniture businessman from St. Louis, Missouri. We don't know if maybe Cecilia had been employed by him or maybe owned by him, and maybe that's how she ended up in Portland. We don't know. But she was here by 22 years old, 1870. By 1875, she had started up her own hairdressing salon, own hairdressing business, and we will see the actual location downtown where she operated at. She operated in several different places, but there's one place in particular that we'll go to, and then she opened up another location down on Front Avenue, and we'll go by that one as well. But she ran that for several years, and she later had to retire due to old age. And there's a very interesting story about her when she did pass away. A very interesting connection between her and the famous Huber's Saloon that's still open downtown at this time. And that saloon...
It's the cafe now.
Yeah, and that's the saloon that goes back to 1879 and is still running. And we have an interesting story about that also between Huber's Saloon and this early female African-American pioneer, Cecilia Blackwell. Very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. These stories of connections among communities very fascinating details. I just wanted to comment also, as I did on the tour, about the distances that these people have traveled. You know, I mean, nowadays, like, you think, like, I'm born in, you know, Indiana, and then I end up in Portland. Okay, that's feasible. But back in the days, that was a trip.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, definitely. You know, there was another female that had a boarding house over in Northwest Portland, over in Northwest 4th and Everett. And the tour doesn't go that particular route. We go up to Cooch Street, and then we go over to Morrison, and then, of course, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 4th Avenue. But there was a boarding house over on 4th and Everett run by a woman by the name of, her name is Mrs. Lejeune. I have to say Mrs. Lejeune because I can't remember her first name. Mm-hmm. Lucy Lejeune.
Lucy there Lejeune. It is.
And she came out to Portland by 1873. She came from San Francisco, or actually she went from Missouri to San Francisco on the train, and then from San Francisco to Portland on a steamship. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of times how a lot of the people had to travel is the steamship and the train. That's how she was able to do it. And she had a boarding house over there. And her husband was John. And on the census that said that he was born in France. And then another one says he was born in Jamaica, so we're still trying to figure that out. But he may have, his nationality may have been Jamaican, but he maybe spoke French, mm-hmm. or it could have been vice versa. So very interesting. So there was a lot of traveling going on, And, of course, many people who lived in Portland at that time, 1860, 1870, you know, you had to have a horse or you would walk. And there was a lot of horse accidents going on back then, too. You know, we think about car accidents. They had a lot of horse accidents, people falling out of wagons, people getting run over by horses, all kind of things. But the steamship, that was a mode of travel to get around.
So for me, what was one of the most interesting things that you discuss on the tour is, in fact, around, you know, a lot of the, you've been talking about the Black pioneers and how they owned businesses, but very oftentimes they did not actually own the building where the businesses were taking place. Could you talk a little bit about the fact that several Black Portland pioneers actually put some of their money together to buy real estate in the city, but also all the way to Seattle? Talk about that.
Yeah, definitely. There were a concerted effort by 11 African-Americans, one European, and two African-American females. And one of the females was Mary Carr.
Mary Carr, we just talked about her.
And and they all pulled their money together to form what was called the Working Men's Joint Stock Association. And it was incorporated in 1869 right here in Multnomah County. And their very purpose was to buy real estate for African-Americans. And they did, in fact, buy real estate property as far as Seattle and even Tacoma, Washington. And a couple of some of the tracts of land that they purchased are still, to this day, they have people living there. In Seattle, Beacons Hill, for anyone who's listening that is from the Seattle area, if you know Beacons Hill, that was one of the tracts of land that this association purchased right here in Portland.
And it's still Black-owned currently?
I don't know if it's Black-owned now, but there are residents still living there. There are homes there. Okay. I believe there's condominiums there also. It's a real upscale, you know, establishment from what I hear. I've never been there, but I'd like to go now once I found this out. And then in Tacoma, there is a tract of land. I'm still trying to figure out where that's at, but they did purchase that as well. So, yeah, they pulled their money together. And, of course, gold coin was the standard at that time. It was not just paper money. They also would bring down a gold coin because that was how a lot of people could pay, you know, their bills, and their bill notes was gold coin. And so that was going on circulating at the time, too. And they would work all these various jobs. You know, Mary Carr, she had her boarding house, but she would put some of her money to invest in this. And Alfred Carr, the saloon keeper, he was one of the members. No, I take that back. Not Alfred Carr, but George Riley. He was another businessman, African-American early pioneer. And we have a photograph of him, and we will show where he lived at downtown. And he was one of the early founders of this as well. And so many of them pulled their money together for that purpose, too. And maybe the reason why they were looking beyond Portland, going to Seattle, going to Tacoma, is maybe because they were thinking, you know, we could establish some colonies of places of color for people to even migrate up there. And so maybe Portland wasn't the only stop. Maybe they were looking at other places. But then, too, you know, they were also trying to make a profit. It was trying to, you know, business deals to try to, you know, survive and make money just like everybody else. So that was an interesting thing that they were able to do. And that was 1869 when they started that.
Yeah, that was a fascinating story that you shared. Something else that you talked about that existed at the time along the same lines was the Colored Immigrants Aid Society. Can you talk a little bit about what that was and how they, in fact, supported new Black residents arriving into Portland?
Yes, the Colored Immigrants Aid Society was started because of a situation that developed just out of the blue from the South in 1879. And in my book, there's a chapter that I devote to what happened in 1879. And in that year, there was a phenomenon that took place in the South. And it's called one of the most massive migrations in American history. And what happened was thousands of African Americans were leaving the South that year, and many of them were heading to Kansas. And some were going to St. Louis, Colorado, even Utah. Mm-hmm. But they were leaving the South in droves, Delphine, just mm-hmm. leaving Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama.
The Great
Tennessee.
Migration, they call it, right?
Yes, the Great Migration. They call it the Exodus.
The Exodus.
1879, yeah. Oh. And they called these folks the Exodus. I can't even pronounce it. Exodusters. But Neil Irvin Painter, the writer, she wrote a very good book about it that came out in 1976. But it was just a phenomenon. It mm-hmm. just. And, of course, the state of Kansas was not even aware of it. They didn't even know that all these thousands of folks were coming their way. And when many of these African-American families with children, many of them on trains that had been on trains for days, my great-grandparents were on that exodus mm-hmm. also, and which I found out through the study that I was doing. They left this town called Duck Hill, Mississippi, and they ended up in a little small community called Osage City, Kansas. And many of them were on trains for several days, Mississippi to St. Louis, St. Louis to Kansas. Some went on the steamships. Some steamships refused to pick up some of the families. And there are some tragic stories of families that were just left stranded on riverbanks in the South. And they had already left. Of course, this is 1879. Obviously, slavery has already ended, so there's no more slavery. But there was sharecropping. There was people still living on the land of mm-hmm. their former bosses. And so many of them decided, we're going to leave. We're going to leave this former life, and we're going to find a land of freedom. We're going to go to Kansas. And many of them didn't make it because steamships refused to pick them up. But thousands of them did. So what happened was, when all these thousands of folks started coming into St. Louis, Missouri, St. Louis formed what was called the Colored Refugee Relief Board to provide food, shelter, clothing, and transportation for many of these families to get to Kansas. Well, eventually, I guess that Colored Refugee Relief Board had a split. There was a little split in the some of the members that mm-hmm. were on there. So one gentleman by the name of James Milton Turner decided he was going to form the Colored Immigrants Aid Society, and he was in Missouri. And so there was a national organization, actually, which I found out, which I didn't know. So in response to that, the Portland community here of African-American color decided to form the Portland mm-hmm. Colored Immigrant Aid Society as kind of like a sister chapter to support what was going on with the other societies. And basically what their purpose was to recruit and assist any who wanted to come out to Portland. Mm-hmm. And they would have fundraisers in the city. The monies would go into publishing information about Portland. They would even pay for their railroad fares, and they would provide short-term housing and employment assistance to any families who wanted to come out. And so, like I said, many of them went to Kansas, but some went even to Colorado, Utah, and I'm still trying to document if any of them ever did come to Portland, but I know that that was part of that movement. They were trying to see if any of them wanted to come to Portland, and if they did, they would help them out. So it was called the Portland Colored Immigrant Aid Society, founded in 1879, in response to this phenomenal movement that was going where thousands were just leaving the South and looking for freedom. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's completely amazing that those the details, you know, really make the difference, you know, in understanding the leadership that was there, that existed, and the things that were done to support the community. So, yeah, awesome example. We're going to talk about another example, which was the one around integrating the schools. But first, we're going to take a short musical break. You're listening to Bread and Roses. This evening, we're talking with Stephen Hanks, who has designed the Pioneer, the Portland Pioneers of Color walking tour of downtown, highlighting some of the first Black folks who lived in Portland. And when we come back, we're going to talk more about that. We're going to go to Born on the Bayou. This is Creedence Clearwater Revival. Stay tuned. Listening to Bread and Roses, I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and on the phone we are joined by Stephen Hanks. He is a local genealogist, historian, designed the Portland's Pioneers of Color walking tour. I'd love to invite you. Tomorrow there is a tour starting at 1:30 p.m. So it starts on the east side of Southwest 1st and Ankeny, right next to the Portland Saturday Market. You can't miss Stephen. He'll be standing in the corner. Stephen, can you talk... another so fascinating story that you actually tell at the close of the tour is the story of an early attempt in the 1860s to integrate a school downtown. Can you share the story with us?
Yes. This was a very interesting story that when I learned about it as well, and definitely wanted to include it in the tour. We think about school integration. We think about 1957, Brown versus Board of Education. We even think of right here in the city of Portland, the 1960s and 70s, where the Portland mm-hmm. Public School District was going through a desegregation time period. And so we think about that time frame there. But let's go back 100 years prior mm-hmm. to the 1860s right here in Portland. There was a movement going on right back then to integrate the Portland School District. And there was a Portland pioneer of color who came out to Portland from Maryland with his four minor boys. And I don't know too much about his wife, his first wife. He did marry later, but he was a bootmaker. And we will go to the location of where he used to have his shop down on the front on the Natal Parkway there. But he was a bootmaker, and 1867, he sent his four boys up to the Portland school at this time, and I won't give it away where that school used to be, but you know where it is, and anyone who comes on the tour will be shocked to find out where that school used to be. But he sent his four boys up there one day to attend school, and unfortunately, the school sent those kids right back home the same day. Well, this gentleman, his name was William Brown, the bootmaker. He didn't give up. He said, I want to send my kids. I want them to get a good education. I'm a taxpayer here, so why shouldn't I have access to the school system? And mind you, at that time, there was no law written in the 1860s that African Americans could not go to the Portland public schools. There was no law that barred that. The only stipulation was that you live in the district and you could go. And if you didn't live outside the, if you didn't live in the district, you just paid a certain fee to have your children go. So it was not like you couldn't bring them at all. Well, William Brown and his kids did live in the district. They lived downtown, and so within walking distance. So he sent the kids back up there again, and the same thing happened. They were sent back home. Well, to make a long story short, there were other families that African-American families that were also trying to get their kids to get into the school district here. So they contacted a minister, and his name was Thomas Alexander Wood, to, be the middleman, the spokesperson for the families. And so he approached the school board and explained the situation to them, and the school board wasn't going to have anything to do with it. And so eventually the families decided to get an attorney. And they did hire an attorney by the name of David Logan, who I believe he used to be the mayor of Portland earlier. And in the time that they filed the papers in the courthouse and served the school district, the school board decided they would go ahead and provide the funds for the school. That was not the idea of the African-American families. They wanted to go to the main school. They did not want to have a separate school, but eventually, to make a long story short, we'll talk more about it in detail on the tour, but
yes.
Basically, they made a compromise, and they said they would set up a colored school, is what it was called. And that went into effect in 1869 and went until 1872. And I did find some more information out just this week about this that I didn't have last week.
Wow.
I found out there was an article in the Oregonian. Apparently, when the colored school, as they called it, got going, and this was on the corner of 4th and Columbia, where the building was at. Apparently, when the kids got out, when the African American kids got out of school, apparently some of the other kids in the area would go down and they would throw rocks at them,
and goodness.
All kind of things, and they would instigate fights with them and all kind of things going on. Yeah, so that's something I just found out just this week, so I'm going to definitely include that in the tour this Saturday. What some of the things that were going on there, and the Oregonian even put an article out condemning that those actions of these big bully kids that were going down there trying to start fights with the African American kids. The Oregonian just said this is not right, and I was very shocked that they came forward on that, and they were not in support of that at all. So eventually, in 1873, though, the school board had a meeting where they voted to disband the colored school. And so in 1873 was when we finally had full integration in the Portland School District, 1873. And then, of course, we could talk more about the educational system, what happened later on,
yes.
1960s, 1970s, but at least 1873, Portland can be proud that they at least got on the program with integration there. But it was just an interesting story that William Brown, he started it, with his four boys.
I also found it so interesting that his name is Brown, because then the famous case in 1964 that established the end segregation is Brown versus Board of Education Topeka. So,
amazing.
Yes, you and I are history nerds. That's probably why we found this fascinating.
I was just thinking about that too. I was like, wow. I didn't even think about that, and then somebody on the tour brought that up and says, just like Brown versus Board of Education. And I said, oh, wow, that's right. And they have the same last name. I didn't even think about that. So,
yes.
And that's one thing I enjoy about the tours. people are engaged in it, and they ask me questions mm-hmm. that I don't even think about. And so it makes me want to, you know, do more research to mm-hmm. you know, include that.
It's participatory.
Yes, exactly.
And so one of the questions actually I had on the tour, because I was very curious, you show a lot of articles from the Oregonians, little clips, news clips from the Oregonian newspaper. And if can you talk about a little bit the kinds of information that you found looking at the newspaper, knowing that the first issue was published on December 4th, 1850?
Yeah, one thing that I noticed that was kind of interesting was that in the early issues of the Oregonian, in referring to people of color, African-Americans in particular, when it referred to them as a group, they would often use the words like colored, just like throughout the whole nation at that time. Mm-hmm. And I understand the context because slavery had just ended. The 13th Amendment had just been passed. The 14th Amendment hadn't even been passed yet in some cases, so as far as granting citizenship. So mm-hmm. there was a lot of these unanswered questions as far as how does the African-American fit into the society and how do they fit into the city of Portland, where the 14th Amendment had not even been passed yet. And so, you know, they're not viewed as U.S. citizens. But mm-hmm. I found that the Oregonian would use the word colored and referring to them as a group. But as time went on in the 1870s, and the 14th Amendment got passed, the 15th Amendment was passed in 1870, that whenever they would refer to a Portland pioneer of color, they would just refer to them as by their name without any racial designation attached to that name at all. And I found that very fascinating. They would just say, for example, Charles Bisseloo or Alfred Carr. They didn't say anything, you know, other than that, just who they were, and that was that. But then as time went on, as you got toward the end, to the close of the decade of the 1890s and to the turn of the century, then I started noticing some of those racial terms started coming back in, Negro, John Brown, color, and so forth like that. And then it started attaching it to the individual person. So I thought that was kind of interesting, but as we got into the 1900s, it started becoming more of a racial identification of Portland citizens. But there's fascinating articles in the Oregonian, and I'm still trying to comb through and try to find some more things. But it was very, very interesting.
Yes, and thank you so much for sharing all of the things that you have found. It's hours and hours and hours, I know, of tedious work that you've put into that. In the last 30 seconds that we have, would you tell us what's next for you? You have the Key Tree book. You have this tour, this walking tour. What's next for you, Stephen Hanks?
Well, I would like to maybe write a book based on my mother's side of the family. I'm working on a screenplay on my first book, and I would like to just add more stories to this tour. People are going to be surprised when they find out about the first African-American newspaper, where that is now at one time. And I just know that this tour is very important to me because I walk by these places all the time downtown and never knew that history was going on. And now when I go by First Avenue or Front Avenue or Fourth Avenue, now I know what happened on those corners. So I hope people will come out and enjoy the history as well.
Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for joining us this evening and for bringing this tour to the Portland community. Such a beautiful gift.
Thank you for having me, Delphine. Appreciate it. We'll keep it tight.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, audience, you can find out more on Facebook about dates and times. Look for Portland Pioneers of Color Walking Tour. There's a tour that starts tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. on the east side of Southwest 1st and Ankeny, right next to the Portland Saturday Market. Thank you for listening to Bread and Rizzes. We are a collective of women-identified radio activists, and we are always looking for new members to host, produce, or engineer with us. You can find out more by going to kboo.fm/breadandrizzes or also on Facebook, KBOO Bread and Rizzes. Have a great week, everyone, and I'll leave you here with Where Have All the Flowers Gone? This is Earth, Wind, and Fire. Have a great week.
welcome to your Friday edition right here. It is the Hard Knock Radio coming up. It's straight up at the top of the hour. You're listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. My name's Erickson, and Friday edition of Hard Knock Radio will be coming up momentarily.
Join KBOO Saturday afternoon from 5 to 7 p.m. for your weekly dose of the blues. The first and third Saturday, Tom Witt. And the second and fourth Saturdays, we welcome back Lenita Duke to the KBOO airwaves. That's Saturday afternoon blues at 5 p.m. on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Peace, y'all.